We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it's shaped our thoughts in a current release. I'm Tosh Robinson, here with
Scott Tobias.
And Genevieve Kosky.
This week, Keith Phipps is out on tour as teen singing sensation Keith Bravo, but we're predicting that phase of his career will fizzle and he'll be back to the table soon. Here on the Next Picture Show, we believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week, we're looking at the fine art of the straight-faced cinematic parody through a pair of films that sprung from popular TV shows. Genevieve, I need to take a break to brush my lustrous hair 1,000 times so everyone will pay more attention to me. Can you take over from here?
Tasha. Well, back in 1969, ABC launched one of the last classic-era family sitcoms, The Brady Bunch, which was the story of a lovely lady. Well, if you've heard the theme song, you know the drill. And if you don't, we'll get into it on the show. The Brady Bunch ran for 5 years and became an American staple that gave us a handful of tropes we're still seeing in sitcoms and series today. And in 1995, Betty Thomas directed a feature-length parody, The Brady Bunch Movie, which flawlessly emulates the original show's look and feel, mostly without winking at the audience about the comedy. You can see a similar tone in the new film Baywatch, a big-screen action comedy version of the TV series Baywatch, which launched in 1989 and kept David Hasselhoff on TV throughout the entirety of the 1990s. Both the Brady Bunch movie and the Baywatch movie are bringing TV to the movies, but they also both capture a similar self-aware tone that mostly avoids the fourth wall, but is very aware of exactly where it's positioned.
Yeah, there's a really fine line between playing things straight and pretending to play them straight just enough to make them into a joke. Both of these films straddle that line, and they both play on a sense of cultural nostalgia that works no matter how well or poorly you know the original material. We'll look at some of the broader jokes and some of the really narrow, specific ones after this break.
It's 1995. The world we know has changed.
Put on your Sunday best, kids. We're going to Sears.
But the Bradys never will. With Mike.
If your sister would wear her glasses, she just might improve her eyesight.
Carol.
Honey, I think you've stirred that enough.
I'm not stirring. I'm looking for Katie Carryall's underpants.
Greg.
This is a car, Jack.
Well, of course this is a car. Yeah, but my name's not Jack. It's Greg.
Bobby and Cindy.
So why don't you hop back on the Swiss Miss package where you belong, huh?
Okay.
Peter.
Lunch looks pretty rank.
What'd you bring?
Pork chops and applesauce.
Jan.
Hi, everybody. It's the new Jan Brady.
Marcia.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, my nose.
I'm sure no one will ever notice.
No, I'll never be a teen model.
And Alice. The Brady Bunch movie.
Marcia did it again. Marcia.
These days, we spend a lot of time talking about gender representation in the film industry. Given how hard it is for women to break in as directors, producers, and screenwriters, and given how low the comparative percentages are of women at top levels in the film industry, the career of Betty Thomas seems even more surprising. Thomas was a Second City comedian who worked with Bill Murray in his time with the troupe, and she eventually moved to L.A. when the Comedy Shop opened up a West Coast branch. She worked first as a bit player in various films, and eventually wound up with a long-running role on Hill Street Blues. Then she broke into directing through television on shows like Doogie Howser, M.D., and with an Emmy-winning job on HBO's Dream On. She branched into directing films with the 1992 comedy Only You. So when the script for the Brady Bunch movie landed in her hands, she was in an unusually good position to take it up. She had an extensive background in comedy, she'd been in television on both sides of the camera, and she'd already made her mark in Hollywood. In interviews, she said she liked the satirical, absurdist edge of the script, but she also liked the fact that it hadn't been written as a vehicle for anyone, and it didn't come with any stars attached. As much as possible, she wanted to cast unknowns so they could represent the original characters more readily. The exception in her casting was Shelley Long, a well-established star from Cheers, and Fall Guy Michael McKean, who was a full-fledged movie star at that point. But most of her cast came without the baggage of stardom, and she could focus on finding people who embodied roles that were, to some TV watchers at least, extremely familiar. That's part of the weird alchemy of the Brady Bunch movie. The six kids, with Long and Gary Cole playing their parents, and Henriette Mantel as their livid maid Alice, all give big, bright, fake performances that should be off-putting, and even a little embarrassing. But they're all basically doing impressions of the earlier roles, capturing what was always bright, fake, and a little embarrassing about the original Bradys. The genius of the Brady Bunch movie, and its more slapstick follow-up, A Very Brady Sequel, is that as much as possible, Thomas just preserves the specific look, tone, and feel of the original show, but contrasts it with an equally stylized 1990s setting to show how absurd both forms of narrative falsity feel. She isn't saying that the Bradys look false compared with the real world today. She's showing us how often entertainment creates an artificial idea of how the world around us looks. Bringing one era's idea of normalcy into another era helps show us how entertainment changes over the decades, but it also reminds us that it's all ultimately artificial, and that what we see as normal on TV today may look just as stylized and phony in 20 years. That aside, though, the Brady Bunch movie is funny because it's such a spot-on, accurate parody. It's nostalgia humor, the kind of joke that lands best if the audience thinks, hey, I recognize that. But even for people who never really watched the Brady Bunch, so much of the show had become culturally ubiquitous by the time of the movie, it was possible to get that nostalgic buzz just more or less out of the air. Am I wrong about that, guys? I was never a Brady Bunch watcher, but I still found these movies really funny the first time I saw them. Do you feel like you need to have seen the show to get why Thomas's movie is funny?
I don't know, because I had a lot of experience watching the show. I watched a lot of Brady Bunch when I was a kid, and so I really don't know. I mean, I think there's so many specific details in the movie that reference the show that, you know, I guess you would miss those if you hadn't been familiar with it. So.
Yeah, but I never watched a Brady Bunch regularly on TV. I think I probably saw some episodes on Nick at Night, but I think just a lot of these references, like Tasha said, were like kind of are in the air, like your Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. And like the theme song, obviously, like the theme song kind of tells you a lot about it. But I also don't know the extent to which I agree that like this movie is dependent on those references. Like, I think the references that are in it work because they are so weird in context. Like, there's an extra level of nostalgic appreciation to them. But like the way this movie is set up with the Bradys kind of like in this bubble in the 1990s, it just adds this layer of weird comedy to whatever they do, whether you understand the reference point or not.
It also kind of works as drama. I mean, the gag where Marsha gets hit in the face with a ball is a reference, is a specific reference to something that happened on the TV show. Yeah. But you don't need to know that, both for it to play as like the slapstick comedy of somebody fall down, go boom, and for it to play as the drama of she's upset about what it does to her face, she's upset about how it'll affect her date, and her sister Jan, who is incredibly jealous of her, is delighted and has happy dreams about it. Like, oh, all of that plays without you knowing that it's a specific callback to the show.
For sure, though I will say that one of the things I really love about this movie is that as much as it is itself aware and full of these sort of odd jokes and absurdist moments and this fish out of water stuff, it actually does evoke the feeling of watching the show at times. I mean, you remember those interiors and those outfits and the weirdly cheery family dynamic that went down. It's, you know, very clean.
But it tweaks it, too. Like, the sexual innuendo in this movie is hilarious for how, like, PG it is, but because it's in the context of this squeaky clean TV series, it's like an extra level of naughtiness to it. Like, I love the characterization of Mike and Carol's kind of, you know, low-key horn dogness around each other. And then also, like, Alice is kind of like a Catskills comedian. She's all, you know.
Her jokes about Sam.
We'll get into the characters, but I really like how the film takes aspects of these characters that were present on the show and then just blows them up to some absurd proportions. I mean, Jan is a big example, but Alice, it's such a tale of desperation and sadness, and like, you know, this woman who is, we were told in the film, is working for free basically, and is pining for this Sam the Butcher who is never going to do anything for her. It's for her to like make those wisecracks about that, and everyone to just laugh and say, "Oh, Alice," it almost hurts to watch, and that's an aspect of the show. I mean, you kind of wonder, you know, what the deal is with Alice when you watch the Brady Bunch. And that's something that the Brady Bunch movie does well, too, is just it points out aspects of the show that you just accepted at the time. And it's like, hey, wait a minute. They all share one bathroom, and then they have a weird AstroTurf lawn. It's just
happened to Tiger?
They don't have a toilet.
Oh, that's right.
Why would they have a toilet? You're never going to see it on TV, so they have a bathroom without one.
And then there's a great like callback to that later in the movie where you see Michael McKean walking through Sears holding a toilet, which is just like,
why is he buying a toilet?
I think it's like kind of a little nod to the fact that like you couldn't show toilets on television. So like now we're in this movie where it's in the 90s and here is someone carrying a toilet, but it's not in a bathroom. Like there's just this like extra level of like, here is a toilet, that making it like super weird.
He's like literally presenting it to the camera.
Yeah.
I was thinking about, now that you mentioned Sears, it seems to me that Sears as a department store is almost where the two eras come together, right?
Oh.
Because, I mean, you don't think of Sears as being a particularly modern, hip place to be.
Nope. That's where you get your Oshkosh bagash.
Right. So it naturally is a place where the Bradys feel kind of comfortable. And, you know, at the same time, it is existing in this world of the 90s. And they kind of merge. It's kind of the perfect department store for both of those worlds to collide.
Yeah, I can't help but wonder whether they got sponsorship money from Sears for, like, the big, bright, oh, my gosh, we're going to Sears. But what this reminded me of more than anything is the like, whole town hullabaloo over the Wells Fargo wagon coming in Music Man. I mean, it's just like, oh, my gosh, family, we're going to Sears. And, like, they don't even bother to underline it with, like, you know, Sears is where we can get everything, including presumably the hideous clothes that we wear.
Yeah,
like, where do those things come from?
Alice sews them.
You think Alice rather than Carol?
I mean, Carol's very busy. She has a lot to do at home all day that Alice needs to take care of all the housework.
And sewing people hideous clothing is part of the housework.
The problem is I watched a little bit of the sequel, and now I'm thinking, which one has the joke she says she needs Alice to make the lunches that she hands?
Yeah,
that's
in the first
one. That she hands to the kids.
Yeah,
I'm in the same boat. I find the sequel funnier. I mean, the sequel is considerably broader, and it goes much further with like just the nonstop references.
Right.
But it also it's more satirical. It's more pointedly making fun of the original. The first one plays it a little straighter, I think. But they're both streaming free on Hulu if you have a membership. Mm-hmm. So we watch them back to back, and then we watch some of the Brady Christmas special where they're all grown up and they all come back home. And then we watched some actual Brady Bunch TV, just for comparison, just to see how they
Tasha
all played with
does
each
her
other.
Research. This podcast has been sans research for a couple of weeks, so she is bringing it this time.
Oh my gosh.
I didn't think of it as research. We were literally just it was the equivalent of channel surfing around
you were
Hulu.
Geeking out on for the first person in history to geek out on the Brady Bunch.
Well, the second after Betty Thomas, because she did her research. Like it's really interesting to watch an actual episode. Like a late series episode when Greg's a teenager and watch it like back to back with the Brady Bunch, because like the layout of the house isn't precise. The layout of the grounds isn't precise, but like the look and feel is. And what's really incredible is just like the feeling of it. Betty Thomas was really specific about wanting TV style directions. So she's like, she's working with fixed cameras. They don't pan to follow characters very often. The direction completely changes when you get outside the little cloistered environment. But within the cloistered environment, she's like using the TV show's wipes. She's using the camera setups. She's using like the medium shot environment of a television sitcom. And that's one of the reasons it feels so familiar is it's just like a visual clone of what you were looking at in the TV show.
The lighting too, like within the house, it just has that very like flat sitcom-y look to it. And you're right, like a lot of the shots are taken right from what I remember of the TV show. Like I specifically think of that kitchen table shot, you know, like the camera's in the exact angle it is when you remember those shots from the series.
For me, it's the staircase. The thing where they
why do we walk so close together?
Where they all come down the staircase in order is like that's straight out of the show.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, one of the things I really admire about this film is that the concept of it solves the problem of its very existence, right? Because if you think about it, I mean, you would never in a million years just do a straight up movie version of the Brady Bunch. That would be that'd be terrible. So it's like, how do you make the Brady Bunch for the 90s? And then it's like, oh, okay. You just they stay the same and everything in the 90s are the 90s, and that's the problem that's solved.
But then the counterpoint to that is what the film thinks of as the 90s, which is as quaint as the 60s, well, 69 to 74, but as quaint as that era looked in the 90s, looking back on it, looking at this film's version of the 90s is kind of hilarious, because it's all just people won't get off their giant handset sized health cell phones. Mm-hmm. They don't talk to each other anymore. They're just standing around with their giant phones with a great big antenna on the top of them.
But those
them.
Are observations that hold up today. The phones got smaller, but the point remains.
Oh,
you know?
I know. And it's shot exactly the same. It's just the exasperation, because they're all talking on their phones. Mm-hmm. They're not playing games on their phones. They're not texting. They're conversing with other people. But other than that, and the fact that the phones are gigantic, it's shot exactly the same way. But then you get into, you know, kids and their grunge styles, right. And their grunge music. Like, today's music is raw and has like a different edgy sound, mm-hmm. and everybody's wearing their saggy plaid shirts, man.
There's such good payoff when Davy Jones shows up at the dance and you get like the grunge version of Girl or whatever the name of that song is. And it's just like the moment when Davy Jones kind of looks around, he's like, okay, I guess this works. Like, it kind of like it works for the whole movie. Like, okay, 70s plus 90s. I guess it works.
Why not?
Yeah.
So that the performances here, like, it feels like they shouldn't work, because they're all so big. They remind me of people like gunning for the back seats on Saturday Night Live when they're doing impressions. But I mean, they're hilarious. And part of it's that familiarity, and part of it's just, I mean, it's part of the environment of this TV show. They feel familiar again. I mean, do they work for you? Do they all work for you?
Jan. I love all the performances. Are really good, and they're all super heightened with like just the right amount of weirdness. But Jennifer Elise Cox is just on a different level. I think like that character is probably the best written of the kids. Just, she's got a whole like schizophrenia line, you know, and Jennifer Lee's Cox just like sinks her teeth into it, and every single line reading is just funny to me to even think about.
Yeah, that scene with RuPaul, right?
Yeah.
Oh my god, that's when she this is getting a psychological evaluation, and she's paranoid schizophrenic, which is, again, you know, that's the key.
She's not schizophrenic. She just doesn't like her glasses.
That's true.
Come back when you're pregnant.
But this is like this like internal monologue is just incredible.
It's me, the new Jan Brady.
Let's knock over a 7-Eleven.
I could really just quote Jan this entire podcast. I'll stop, but I could.
I mean, then I would start quoting Marcia just to get back to, like, I can't believe we all have to go to school. I'm assuming that is, I didn't look that one up, but I'm assuming that there's some point in the TV show where she pronounces it school. Mm-hmm. And so they just decided that had to be a running gag. It's completely uncommented on, but it's also really consistent. And it's just her.
I think Jan not wearing her glasses and running into things, I think that happened on the show as well.
Oh yeah.
So that's from the show too. As far as the other casting is concerned, I think it's really just anchored well by Shelley Long and Gary Cole, who again, just especially Gary Cole, just turns it up a little bit, you know. Mm-hmm. And they find a couple of things to focus on, and my favorite being the telephone conversation.
Yeah.
where he has kind of this weird cheery response to everything that's said on the other line, and then
punctuated by Shelley Long's like facial expressions, like reacting to everything he says with like hope, then dismay, then hope, then dismay.
and trying to get a word in edgewise while he's doing his like circular logic Cohen's, like, it's a lot of fun. Like,
you're a tattletale, you're telling on yourself.
Getting longer and more bizarre. This is kind of the beginning of Gary Cole's career. He'd been in, he'd had a couple of minor roles, and then he was in the Line of Fire. And apparently that was kind of his audition, was like they showed him in the Line of Fire to Betty Thomas.
He was in Fatal Vision, was like, he was like all 4 hours of that, which I and many folks at the time watched in large numbers.
Tosh and I are both like,
we're both looking it up right now.
But it was a good showcase, early show. I'm kind of a Gary Cole actor, or if you're like, if you say auteur, maybe an actor for Gary Cole, I did a piece way back in the day on character actors for the AV Club, and he was the reason why I did it.
I
think Gary Cole just makes everything better, including the Brady Bunch.
He certainly makes this better. But yeah, Thomas apparently thought he was too hard-edged, and he wasn't going to be able to bring it. Like, he wasn't going to be able to get the Mike Brady feel at all. And then he did some lines for her. And she's like, okay, probably. And then apparently they put the wig on him. And she's like, all right, you have the role. But yeah, I mean, Shelley Long's performance is kind of like dialed up with the big-eyed battiness. Mm-hmm. And he kind of takes the other direction. Like, he's very serious about it. Which, off the top of my head, I can't remember who played Mike in the actual Brady Bunch show. I remember, like, he hated the fact that this was what he was known for. He hated being on the show.
Robert Reed.
Robert Reed, of course, right. About his feelings about the show. But I think that comes through in the performance that he gives as that character.
That Gary Cole gives?
Reed gives. And then Gary Cole is kind of picking up on that, serious patriarch who takes himself very seriously. And he becomes kind of the fulcrum, which a lot of things in the film revolve around. Because, again, they're all doing this, big, bright, silly thing. With music videos, and he's like standing there stroking his chin and dispensing weird wisdom.
All right, troops, off to school.
Goodbye.
Have a good day.
Bye, Mom. Bye, Dad.
Bye, Mom.
Come on, Marcia.
I'm coming.
Jan, a real friend likes you for who you are, not what's on your face. If you judge your friends for passing judgment on you, you're not only judging yourself, you're judging your friends for judging you, and that would be using bad judgment.
I never thought of it that way.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
See, I've always believed that it doesn't matter where your home is, because home is where your heart is. And we may lose this house, but we'll always have our family because we're Brady's. And this family is our home. That's why we'll always have our home. As long as we have our family, even if we lose our house, we're still Brady's.
Your father's right.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I feel like there's just a big balancing act. There's a balancing act between the Carol performance and the Mike performance. There's a balancing act between pretending they're all taking it very seriously and, obviously playing things up. What else do you see going on as a balance in this movie that makes it work?
Marcia and Jan have a dynamic going on, and Cindy and Michael McKean have their sort of back and forth as well. I mean, I don't know. The characters do kind of tend to pair off to some degree how they would on the show. I mean, that rivalry between Marcia and Jan was a pretty big part of the show.
I also think it's interesting how this movie deals with the 90s disconnect, because it could be so cynical. It could be making fun of the Bradys, but there's so much in this movie where it's like, if you go up against the Bradys, the universe will punish you. You know, the universe is on the Brady's side. Like, Michael McKean's character is definitely the butt of that more than anything else. Like, he gets electrocuted.
That joke was one for the really little kids in the audience, I thought.
Yeah.
The electrocution joke.
But I think it fits with what the movie is doing. Because, even the end where they win the contest, where, everyone's like, what are they doing? But they win because the judges are the monkeys, you know? it's it always works out for the Bradys. The universe is on the Brady side, and I think that keeps it from indulging in the kind of 90s cynicism of losers, you know.
It's like a softer version of the Grimy episode of The Simpsons.
Grimes, yeah.
Or is this just that feeling that they live a weird blessed life? And it's, I think you see it most, there's just that moment that it always hits home for me no matter how many times I see this movie, where Cindy is headed out to give the neighbors the mail. Mm-hmm. And when she's in the backyard, everything's bright and technicolor and Brady music is playing. When she goes out the back door, suddenly you're hearing grungy, hip-hoppy.
And the camera. You get a camera tilt. Dutch angles and stuff all of a sudden.
And the color changes and the background noise changes. Like, in their backyard, even though it's L.A., there aren't sirens. Yeah. But and then she steps out and it's a completely different world. And so you've got kind of the tension there of the two eras and that sense that it's just all sitting outside their door, you know, AIDS and crack and Bernie Getz. It's just like literally right outside their gate. But as long as the gate's shut, it can't get in.
But at the same time, when they are out in the world, they're also impenetrable. They have a bubble around them. I mean, like you think about like the carjacking
scene. Yeah.
Where they're just cheerfully oblivious to everything that happens. Yeah, or the scene where Marcia and Jan are trying to model or get a modeling job. And the sleazy photographer is trying to tell Marcia all these things that she needs to do, including getting breast implants, and she slaps him for saying that.
Cut my hair.
Yeah, I mean, so I think it's a good point in the sense that the universe does sort of favor them. I mean, in that, you know, the film, I think there might be a temptation for having maybe bringing everybody in the audience on board or something, right?
Yeah.
They do something.
They win them over.
They win them over, right? But yeah. That's not that. It's like this is a mystifying performance for many of them, but. You know, they luck out on the judges.
Yeah. That the whole plot where they win over the neighborhood and everybody decides to just stay where they are, I always feel like there's a couple of scenes missing in this movie that would make the overplot make any kind of sense, because it seems like everybody in the neighborhood has already sold their houses, but they're still living there waiting for the Bradys, and it's like they've got some kind of contract that something's going to go wrong with. It's like they're part of some profit-sharing scheme that involves the Bradys, and yet they don't engage with the Bradys at all because they're super mad at Michael McKean towards the end.
They're going to sue him.
He's cheated them on all this stuff, and it's like if he just bought their houses – like, how is he cheating them? Like, how are they planning on getting their houses back and staying?
I just assume it was all contingent on the Bradys.
Yeah, I think it's like a development. Like, he's like selling it to a developer for like an office park or something. And like, everyone needs to be on board because they're just going to bulldoze the neighborhood.
But it doesn't seem like everybody knows that they've all got to be on board because, again, nobody is engaging with the Bradys. Nobody is like telling them off or, I don't know, throwing rocks through their windows.
But it's a sitcom conclusion. It's a sitcom ending, you know? Like, it works out because it has to work out because we need to reset by the next episode, or in this case, by the next movie, you know? Like, you're right. Like, the whole, like, real estate deal thing makes no sense. But I don't need it to make sense.
Oh,
you
sure.
Know? You know, it's. I think the fact that it doesn't make sense, especially the way that it gets wrapped up, is part of, like, the grand joke that the movie is telling.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of internal logic here. Like, this is the same movie where an electrician leaves a live wire in the ground next to a, like, I don't know, 7-year-old girl and tells her to watch it for him while he runs off to his truck. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here that doesn't... It is not attempting to make any logical sense. Yeah. Well, what do you guys think about the big slapstick of Michael McKean getting smacked around? Like, to me, that just... It feels like it doesn't quite fit in this movie.
No. We were talking about the electrocution scene. It feels like that was done for a younger audience that might appreciate some bit of slapstick. It's not really all that well incorporated into the movie.
I don't know. It didn't. It doesn't. I mean, I'm not like, yeah, I love it when he got electrocuted, but I'm not like, I'm not mad at it. Like, it feels like it fits one level of the humor on this movie. Like, it's not necessarily of a piece with the like very self-aware winking aspect of the humor, but like there is a lot of big broad stupid humor in this film too. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying about the universe punishing you if you go up against the Bradys. Like, I think, like, if you look at Michael McKean's character as like a Wile E. Coyote kind of going after the Bradys and just getting punished again and again and again for it, like, it's fine. Michael McKean gives good electrocuted face, I guess. I don't know. Like I said, I'm not mad at it. It's not my favorite part of the movie, but, you know.
It's just so strange to contemplate that, like, he was probably the biggest movie star in the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, he's...
Shelley Long was a much bigger star than he was.
A bigger movie star, though?
Well, I think just star, period.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, I chose that word carefully. Like, you know, she was a huge star coming out of Cheers. And, you know, and she's got a kind of a bigger, more central role here than he does. But in terms of movie stardom, and he's basically here to get slammed into walls and to make Mean Mug at people. Her character involves a very careful, like, balancing act. And it's very nuanced and tuned and specific. And whereas, you know, he could be played by almost anybody. I mean, he reminds me of Christopher Walken in The Country Bears.
That's a masterful performance, though.
Well, it makes the movie.
it does.
It makes the movie. But again, it's like this big, broad thing that is specific to the actor as opposed to specific to the story.
Yeah, I will agree with you that it's not necessarily a role that Michael McKean needed to play, you know, or he doesn't make it his own necessarily. So to that extent, I agree.
I like Gene Smart as who's kind of into the Brady Boys.
Mm-hmm.
That's a nice touch. And I think
all of them. She likes all of the Brady Boys.
She really does. So does she. And then you do with that one scene, you know, I was trying to think about, do I really like any scenes where Brady is not present? And I do like the scene where the neighbors kind of come over and they're just itemizing all of the weird stuff that the Bradys do. That's a pretty clever thing. But one thing I kind of wanted to talk about too, because we'll get into this a little bit with Baywatch, but there's just, you know, with this movie, the Brady Bunch movie, and with Wayne's World, it was sort of the introduction of kind of a couch potato self-awareness of just of people who had grown up watching TV, often bad TV. I mean, I watched so much Brady Bunch and Silver Spoons and Facts of Life, Family Ties. I mean, these are not good shows, but I watched them. I watched them every night they came on, and the Brady Bunch was something that was on during the day, and I can't really account for that, but there is sort of this thing where you kind of watch shows because they're comforting to you, or you find them funny or silly in some way, and for these films to kind of call attention to that and call attention, you know, and Wayne's World is very rigorous about calling attention to the camera itself and playing to the camera. It was kind of a breakthrough. It was sort of just a way forward in terms of how to do TV on film. Like, there was just another way of doing it, and they kind of found it.
And that said, though, I feel like this film established a really solid formula for how this should work, and then so few films have taken them up on it. Mm-hmm. I mean, 21 Jump Street is kind of the best it gets, but you've got so many other movies. Even before this, you had something like The Addams Family, which was, I mean, it was funny and it was a little self-aware, but it wasn't really making fun of the original Addams Family. It was embracing it and blowing it up. Wayne's World was just expanding something that had been a short and trying to turn it into a full-size thing. And you have all of these Saturday Night Live movies that kind of do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Like, how do we make this full length? But I find it hard to think of another movie between Brady Bunch movie and 21 Jump Street that hit this same point of, like, we're taking the plot sort of seriously, but we're also making fun of the ridiculousness of the original, but we're also keeping a completely straight face.
You mean between these two?
Yes.
Because Charlie's Angels was something to that.
But Charlie's Angels, I mean, it embraces the comedy, but it also kind of takes both the premise and the action pretty seriously. I mean, all of that stuff with Crispin Glover is pretty spooky and pretty cool.
There's also, like, kind of a veneer of wanting to be cool with Charlie's Angels that I don't think you have here. Like, everyone here in this movie is very comfortable looking like a complete fool, you know? And that's not really the case with Charlie's Angels, I don't think.
That's true. Though, again, it's still an example, though, of a television show that you cannot do straight. That you have to figure out some... You have to conceptualize something different around it in order for it to work as a movie.
And then you have, you know, kind of more dire examples like Miami Vice or, I mean, even The A-Team. Like, The A-Team...
Wait, Miami Vice, like the Michael Mann film?
Yeah.
It's a great film.
Yeah, but it's not a comedy, and it's not making fun. I mean,
no, it's not. But
it's not a satire.
No, it's not. But I think that took a different approach, which is like, let's actually do it more seriously and make it kind of hip in a different way.
Sure, but that's what I'm talking about is, like, all of these other films have taken different approaches and have not come back to this formula. Like, I feel like there's a perfect formula here, and almost nobody is learning the lesson.
Other than, I guess, 21 Jump Street learned it pretty well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. These are kind of the bookends. Yeah. And I feel like Baywatch gets closer than most, but we'll get into that in the next podcast.
Yeah, but still not that close.
But I don't know. It seems like the A-Team would have been such a great opportunity to take this approach. I mean, that was really popular show, incredibly cheesy, incredibly formulaic. And then the movie version mostly tries to play it straight.
Yeah. Like, no, it did what took the Miami Vice approach, which is like, let's do something hip out of this. And it was so crappy, you know. It was not, it would have been fun to see a comedy version of the A-Team. Though you almost get it in something like Tropic Thunder or something like that. It's not the A-Team, but just had that shows you how you could do pull something like that off and sort of reveal some of the silliness inherent in that show. But
I feel like I may just be missing out on a bunch of films that might have tried to do this that I never saw, like Dark Shadows or Land of the Lost, Get Smart, like...
Oh, right. Well,
that,
Get Smart
was a Bewitched
comedy.
Movie.
Yeah. Those seem pretty close in tone to the original television show was like.
I mean, I also just think you're dealing with just really rife source material here. I think, like, the Brady Bunch's lack of any sort of serialization or stakes or complicated plots, like, really allowed this movie to just wallow in silliness without having to worry about, like, telling a story that necessarily, like, lives up to what the original TV series was trying to do. Not saying that, like, you know, Chips or something wasn't, like, a stupid enough TV series to make a funny movie, but there's a very precise, specific kind of stupidity to the Brady Bunch TV series that I think engendered this movie.
And I mean, is that a stupidity that you can describe?
No.
I mean, is it is it about the campiness? Was it, I mean, it wasn't that self-aware a show.
Yeah, no, it's not a self-awareness. I think it's a lightness, a frivolousness. Like, there's no weight to it. There's no necessarily potential weight dragging down any comedic statements you want to make about it. There's nothing even remotely difficult or complicated about the Brady Bunch. No. It's just, it's like all frosting.
Well, consider the period. I mean, the period was perfectly fraught in America at the time. Again, I'm drawing on memories of my childhood here, but it almost seems like the show was as much this unreal, you know, oasis from reality as it is in the Brady Bunch movie, you know, in terms of it being that removed from what's happening in the 90s. I don't think the Brady Bunch, you know, as it ran originally, really spoke to what was happening in the culture in any way. And I think that might have been the appeal, you know, particularly for a family audience, is of just being able to escape into this world where everything is orderly and nice, and you have a lot of digestible, silly plots. You know, you got the volcano thing, and you got a cursed idol in Hawaii.
Well, now you're getting into the sequel again.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a reference to this. But that actually happened on the show.
Yeah.
But you know what I'm saying. It's just, I mean, a lot of the more famous references are covered in one of the movies or the other. But again, I think it probably had as little to do with its contemporary era as it did to the 90s.
That's interesting.
Maybe the fashions were probably a little more.
But you know what? Like, that era of the 90s was also, like, there was a huge 70s revival happening in fashion, too. Like, maybe that was, like, a couple years after 95, but I don't think so. I think this is when, like, 70s was making a comeback, like, trend-wise. So it's interesting that that's, like, not in the movie, but maybe there's just a couple years disconnect there.
Marcia gets along okay.
Well, she's a groovy chick.
Mm-hmm. It's got it going on in a really happening kind of way.
Far out happening way.
Speaking of having it going on in a far out happening kind of way, what do you guys make of the musical numbers?
I love how the song fades out during their talent show performance. And they all just bow until the song has faded out. Like, that's just such a good visual sonic joke.
I think it's interesting that they at least are semi-trying to lip-sync the stage number. But when they're doing the mall number, they're not. Like, it's a music video. It's not pretending to be them out in the world singing. And I mean, it gives you kind of a different feel. But I love the music video of them running through Sears, being excited by everything they see.
I'm surprised that they didn't take advantage of Peter's voice. I mean, they do a little bit, but like...
Yeah,
but that
he gets
like
a full-on Elvis moment.
He does, but like, of course, that's not really the way it worked on the original TV show, that whole Time to Change video. Remember that? Like, they were all set to perform, but then Peter's voice was changing, and so they incorporated that squeaky voice into the song itself. Time to Change, you gotta look it up. It's good stuff. play that clip on the show. That's gold.
I guess just the only other thing I want to bring up is, I don't know where the script came from, and I'm a little baffled by it, because, you know, I read interviews with Betty Thomas where she talks about getting hold of the script and being happy because, you know, it wasn't made for somebody in particular who wanted to be in one of these roles. But there's no clarity as to where it originated, who came up with it in the first place. There are four credited writers. Two of them, Terry and Bonnie Turner, like, were big That 70s Show people. Mm-hmm. Like, writers on hundreds of episodes, literally. And then the other two credited writers are Larice Elhoiny, who's got, like, he wrote My Girl and My Girl 2, and that's really pretty much it. And Rick Kopp, who has a whole bunch of kids' TV under his belt, and that's mostly it. Things like The Adventures of Captain Zoom in Outer Space. And I don't know if the Turners wrote it and the other two were brought in to punch it up, or the other two wrote a version of it. I found one reference to there being, like, many, many drafts of it. But I don't know anything about the story. And I can't help but wonder if the uniqueness of this movie is because it was somebody's weird passion project that just kind of got, like, passed along and script doctored into something a little more conventional in a comedy sense, but still a lot unconventional, both for its era and just for the idea of transforming TV into film.
I mean, I think once you get into that many writers and that many drafts, and I'm sure there are uncredited people as well, it can be so hard to really understand who deserves credit for what.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want somebody to do the definitive oral history of this movie. The readership for that includes the three people at this table and maybe four of the people listening to this podcast.
Be surprised. This movie's got people like the Brady Bunch movie.
Sequel's all funnier, right, though.
Tasha really wanted us to do the sequel for this episode.
Oh yeah, we had a big argument. This is something we should we were really asked to do, and we should be doing more of, is just the pairings that we considered a thing. And this one, we went through a lot of different iterations of this. We talked about doing Wayne's World, you know, which is earlier, but I think has a really different vibe from Baywatch in terms of that self-seriousness thing.
Yeah, I think that Wayne's World was a real Rosetta Stone, really, has been of self-aware comedy. That was what I was thinking, but then the Brady Bunch movie sounded great to me. And I think it'd be too, you know, 21 Jump Street is almost too recent to get into. Yeah.
Too recent for a pairing.
Oh, that's funny.
And it's also, like, it's too similar a mode of comedy, I think, to Baywatch. I mean, it pulls it off a lot better than Baywatch does. Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert for the second half of this episode. But, I mean, the Brady Bunch movie is from a different era of comedy. You know, like, film comedy worked different in the mid-90s than it does in the aughts, you know? So I don't think it would have been as interesting a contrast.
Yeah. And we talked about doing Brady Bunch 2 just because I think it's funnier and fleeter. But Scott made the pretty compelling argument, I think, that if you're going to compare something, you compare it to the thing that started the trend. You don't compare it to one of the followers. Yeah. But I think we also talked about doing, like, Addams Family and, like, Charlie's Angels, just other TV comedies. But this was the one that seemed to fit best.
I'm really glad we did this one. I've seen this movie many, many times. And I was actually a little apprehensive to revisit it because it's probably been, like, at least 10 years since I've seen it. And I loved it when I was younger, and I was afraid I wouldn't love it as much, but I do.
Speaking of movies you love, one of the other things we talked about doing was Josie and the Pussycats, which you were the one that shot that one down, and I don't remember why.
Because I don't know that, like, the Josie and the Pussycats as a TV series was, like, a big enough touchstone for it to be a valid comparison point here. Like, when I think of Josie and the Pussycats, I think more of the comics, so.
Fun fact, Josie and the Pussycats, the writer-directors of that film, were two of the credited writers on the Brady sequel. Yeah, Harry Elfont and Deborah Kaplan. There are, like, four credited screenwriters on Very Brady sequel, including those two, and then they went on to write and direct Can't Hardly Wait and Josie and the Pussycats. I think both good films, especially Josie and the Pussycats. What a great film.
It is a really great film. That would have been fun to talk about, but this was the right choice. I really enjoyed revisiting this film, and I hope other people enjoyed it, whether they were revisiting it or discovering it for the first time. And if you didn't enjoy it, this is your opportunity to send us feedback, because you know how we love listener feedback. So speaking of listener feedback, we're going to be right back with some listener feedback on some previous episodes.
That's a great segue.
That was very Mike Brady-esque.
Well, just remember, when you're feeding back on the people that feedback on you, you're feeding the people who give you the feedback, and you're feeding them back. I was unfortunately out for our last episodes on Jonathan Demme's Stop Making Sense and Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids, but for our listeners, the Perpetual Concert is apparently still going on. Genevieve, you want to read us a letter about the concert doc experience and the Demme experience in general?
Sure. Adam writes, I was in attendance during Timberlake's performance in Vegas in August 2014, and while I don't have a photographic memory about the show, watching Jonathan Demme's film version brought a lot of it back. The one thing I was made aware of yet again is just how impressive Timberlake is as a showman, and how easy he makes it look. It was the best concert I've ever been to because of his ability to connect with a crowd through charisma and charm, which isn't to take away from how hard he clearly worked to make the show special. Demme's contribution to the documentary absolutely can't be understated. As entertaining as Timberlake is, I've never been able to get into concert docs because so many filmmakers don't understand how to capture what makes these artists great. There's clearly such a love and affinity for music of any variety with Demme that comes across so well in both of these movies. It also helps to be wildly talented, which he also is. My big takeaway from watching four Demme movies in 2 days after learning of his death was just how much empathy there was for virtually every person in his movies. I think Scott brought up the wedding scene and Rachel getting married, about how so many characters get their little moment to tell you so much about who they are. I was so pleased to take a dive into Demme's career and very sad it didn't come until after he left us way too soon.
Ah, what a great letter. I want to adopt Adam. Adam, how old are you? I'll adopt you.
You guys can watch Demme movies
together.
We cut this letter down and it was much longer, but one of the things that he said was they'd only seen like two Demme movies in his life. So this is him starting to get caught up. Scott, I think you want to take him home and show him more Demme.
Yeah, there's plenty more where that came from. He just has that touch. I'm glad that I'm glad to get this letter firsthand, somebody who'd actually seen a Timberlake show and understands how dynamic it is and what Demme himself was able to bring to the table. Adam had a fuller experience of this show than the rest of us did.
Yeah, I haven't caught up on the Timberlake movie or on the podcast, sadly. I mean, I wasn't here to record it because I was traveling and working and super busy. But did you guys get into Ricky and the Flash and all?
No, but I recommended Ricky and the Flash 2 episodes ago for Your Next Picture Show, which we recorded on the night that Demme died. Mm. So this is now 3 episodes in a row that Demme's death has like cast a shadow over, which is...
I'm ready to get... We can do it the next one. It'll be a little tough. You'll hear what the one is on our next show, but I think bringing Demme into that one is going to be a little more complicated. But if you write us nice feedback, we can keep the Demme train rolling along.
Yeah. I want to echo that recommendation of Ricky and the Flash. Because, I mean, if you want to talk about the use of a director who understands how to shoot music mm-hmm. and giving everybody an opportunity to show that they're a character and to give them some sympathy, like, it was a late-in-life film for him, but I loved that film so much.
Yeah.
And it was just such a surprise.
Yeah.
You know? I'd seen so many of his other movies, and I still went into it kind of, like, from the ads thinking, okay. What is this going to be? And I was just so pleasantly surprised by it. I should have learned to trust him.
Yeah. Yep. So, Adam, if that wasn't one of the four Demme movies you watched in 2 days, make that your next one.
There's a lot of good ones, though. Yeah. I mean, I love Ricky the Flash, but there's Melvin and Howard to think about, and Something Wild, and Married to the Mob, and a lot of good movies.
Yeah, hey, you and your new adopted kid are going to have a good time, Scott.
So excited. Adam, this is going to be great.
So in other feedback, Alien Covenant is currently in theaters, so it's not so surprising that we'd get a letter going back a little ways to episodes 70 and 71, where we talked about the new science fiction movie Life and how it stacks up to Ridley Scott's Alien. Here's a response to a response letter about that show. Scott?
All right, we're going in it. This is Daniel. He writes, I apologize for reaching back a ways, but I had to respond to a previous letter on the Alien episode in praise of a film I somehow cannot stop defending. That letter read in part, quote, I was left thinking about the sex and rape metaphor that culminates in the chestburster scene of the alien's lifespan. It had me wondering how the franchise's themes and discussions might have evolved if a later entry had given us an alien that didn't kill the host upon bursting from their chest. Would we find the entire premise just as horrifying if, after a reasonable recovery period and some reconstructive surgery, the human host could go on to live a relatively normal life? Would the rape analogy take on even greater resonance? Or would it somehow lessen the horror and the stakes of the film if audience members couldn't see the alien strictly as a killing machine whose means of reproduction is simply unacceptable? End quote. In point of fact, a later entry did give us an alien that didn't kill the host, namely the little-loved Alien Resurrection, in which a chestburster is essentially delivered by C-section from the body of an Ellen Ripley clone from DNA recovered from the deathbed to which she plunged in the final scene of Alien 3. And in my opinion, yes, the rape analogy does in fact take on greater resonance in this film, as Ripley is forced to reckon with, in short succession, her own non-consensual resurrection, the 7 hideously malformed previous clones of herself, one of which was left alive to suffer horribly, the equally hideous monsters who are effectively her own children by rape, and with whom she shares both genetic material and a terrible but inevitable sympathy, and her own duty to exterminate her misbegotten progeny. Ripley's emotional arc turns to the fact that the alien's means of reproduction is quote-unquote unacceptable, not because it kills its host, but because it happens against the host's will. I think that the combination of revulsion, motherly affection, and a dash of perverse pride that Ripley feels towards the aliens in Resurrection make it one of the most thematically interesting entries in the series, whatever one might say about its flaws. Also, Ripley is part alien. How badass is that?
Oh, I have not seen Alien Resurrection. No. So you've never seen it?
No. I haven't seen it in a long time. And this letter honestly has me wanting to revisit it. I rewatched Alien for our podcast. We rewatched a bunch of Aliens because I was back on Aliens Minute, which is always a fun time. And I mean, I had to revisit Prometheus because I was writing about Alien Covenant, and I watched Alien Covenant, and it has me wanting to go back and see 3 and 4 just kind of to fill in the gaps. And this letter, like, I remember the horrible clones, but kind of digging into the thematic background of that scene and making it like one with all of the horrible things going on throughout this series about rape and pregnancy and non-consensual everything is kind of the heart of the Alien movies. But this makes me really want to go back to a movie that I did not like at the time and see what's there.
Ditto. I don't remember a whole lot about it. I saw it when it came out and didn't really think a whole lot of it, and that was the end of that. So this definitely gives you a lot to think about.
I mean, that said, I really like this letter. I love the fact that we've got readers responding to readers. But I also, I just think that the level of thought that went into this in terms of drawing out a theme that can gets a little muddier and a little more obscure the deeper that you get into the series. Like, it's so sharply defined in Alien, and then it gets a little fuzzy and lost. And this is bringing it back into focus for me in a way I really like.
Yeah. Reminds me a little bit of a Boy George single that, wait a minute, that's not right. That's another time. That's another letter.
Thank you for writing in, Daniel. You know, and anybody else who wants to write in and encourage Scott to sing that song is certainly welcome to do so. As always, we appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode, post it on Facebook for discussion, or have Scott interpret it through song and or dance. That about wraps up this episode of the Next Picture Show. In part 2, we'll look at Baywatch with its slow motion running, its seemingly endless genitalia jokes, and its brotastic brome petition. And we'll see how a different satirical remake of a TV show looks on screen. Look for that later this week. Or better yet, subscribe to the Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice. Follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow and follow us on Twitter at nextpicturepod so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, put on your Sunday best because we're going to Sears.
Woo! No cheers, Scott?
Oh, I'm excited. I gotta get out, give me some of those rays.